Hi friends, this is Brock Polk, and I want to thank you for downloading this sermon from Heritage Church of Christ in Fort Worth, Texas. Our mission is to lead others to a thriving relationship with Jesus, and if you're ready to take a next step in your faith journey after you listen to this message, you can contact us through our website at www.heritagechurchofchrist.org. God bless you, and I hope you enjoy the following message.
I really am thrilled that you're here with us, and I want to thank you for going to the effort to get up and get ready and get here. And if you have young children at your house, then you get bonus points for that, right? Because, I mean, we understand that it can really be a circus to get everybody up and dressed and fed and here for a church service. And it's my hope, it's my dream that this morning on your way home after this service, if your kids are down the hall enjoying children's ministry and the Road to Resurrection program this morning, my hope is that on the way home, they are going to be talking your ear off about how much fun that they had, how much they learned, and everything they got to experience. I hope you're going to drive away thinking it was worth all of that effort, but I know that doesn't make it like easy. It was still challenging. It was still hard. And if your family is anything like me and my family, then sometimes it just feels like being rushed and pressured like becomes the norm, like that becomes what we are accustomed to. We're always late for something. We're always forgetting something. We're always signing up for something else. And if that sounds like your reality, then I just want to extend a special invitation to you to come back and join us for the message series that we're going to start next week. We're going to start a new series that's going to be called Margin. And we're going to be talking about how a relationship with God really is meant to reduce stress and increase the peace in our frantic families and our schedules. And so come again and we'll talk about what's possible for you and your family life. But this morning we're going to continue our focus on this incredible Easter story and how it redefines what's possible for the entire world. So here's how the story goes, okay? 2,000 years ago, in a remote province of the Roman Empire, there was this religious teacher who had a small following of people, and he claimed to be the son of the creator of the universe. And that claim eventually led to his assassination. But the story gets more elaborate than that, because then you find out that before he died, he predicted his own death, and he actually predicted that he would be able to overcome death and rise from the grave 3 days later. Now, nobody understood what he was saying when he said that the first time. Nobody got it. And so 3 days later, when mourners came to the grave and found it empty, and he appeared to over 500 people, and he had the marks of his execution all over him, it was a surprise. It was an incredible story, and it's been inspiring humanity ever since. But of course, the trouble with really incredible stories is that it brings out the skeptic in all of us, right? I mean, when you hear a story that just sounds too good to be true, it kind of makes you suspicious. I can remember a time a few years ago, it was one of those special moments where the entire extended family was gathered around my grandmother's dining room table. You may have a moment like this afternoon at lunch. And it was one of those times when we got grandma talking about what it was like for her growing up as a young girl in the 1920s. And it was awesome, okay? We call her Muzz. And Muzz was sitting there telling us about riding in like the original Model T Fords, and telling us about her dad, who was a home builder. He was a carpenter, and he built houses without the aid of power tools, which I just, you know, can hardly imagine doing. And it was awesome. And then she started telling us about her mom. Everybody called her Mamaw. And she said, now, Mamaw was kind of famous in our region down in South Texas because Mamaw had a madstone. And I said, a madstone? I'd never heard of that before. She acted like this was kind of common knowledge. I said, well, Muzz, what's a madstone? She says, well, a madstone is this little rock that you find in the stomach of an albino deer. I thought, well, naturally, you know, of course that's what that is. But the thing was, she said, the madstone has healing property. She said it can suck the poison out of a bite or a wound that you get. And so people would come to see Mama from all over the area if they got bit by a spider or bit by a snake. And Mama would take that madstone and she'd boil it in milk and then take it out and touch it to that wound, and it would stick for a while, for a couple hours while it was sucking the poison out. And then they'd take the stone back off and put it back in some milk and boil it again, and the milk would turn green because the poison was getting, you know, leached out of that rock in there. And I sat there and listened to my Muzz tell that story, and for the first time in my life, I thought, she's making every bit of this up as she tells it. But I don't think I believe this story. I was really skeptical about it, and so I've got a trick that Muzz didn't have growing up. I've got Google. And so I went to Google and said, tell me about the madstone. And I found a lot of entries about it. I found a lot of stories and legends about madstones that have been passed down, usually from somebody's grandmother, kind of like mine. And they described it the same way. I mean, the milk and all the green and all of that, the whole works. But all of the stories seem to be kind of secondhand. Like everybody would say, I've never actually seen the madstone work, but I know somebody who saw the madstone work. It was one of those kind of deals. I couldn't find any real evidence that said it actually worked. I mean, it was an incredible story. It sounded really good, but I'm going to make you a deal. If I get bit by a snake, I'd like you to just take me to the hospital for the anti-venom instead, because I don't think I trust it quite that much. I'm too skeptical. And I bet most of us would be pretty skeptical about something like that, because most of us learned at an early age to be suspicious of claims that sound too far-fetched. You know, it's like, huh, that doesn't sound just right. We all know the feeling of falling for a hoax, and we don't like that feeling. We don't like to be taken for a ride. We don't like to be treated like a fool. We don't want to be too gullible. And so we are questioning of the stories and the claims and the news that we hear. And you may have noticed that even factual information is facing its own uphill battle these days. We've got politicians presenting alternative facts. And the internet is suddenly full of fake news, and we're being warned that we shouldn't trust the mainstream media sources that we've counted on for years to keep us informed. Last year, the 2016 Oxford Dictionary's word of the year was post-truth, which apparently describes a situation when the truth is no longer thought to be relevant to a given situation. Time magazine about a month ago published an issue where the cover simply asked, is truth dead? And there are so many competing voices, so many sources, and sometimes it's hard to know what to believe, and you definitely can't believe everything you hear or everything you read. You've got to be careful about what sources of information that you trust. And since we all are swimming in that water and living in that culture of skepticism, and we're having to ask, can I really trust what I have read here? I bet you've probably asked yourself, why in the world would I trust this book? Why would I choose to trust this book with all of its outrageous claims? I mean, it's an incredible story, but you know what incredible stories do. They bring out the skeptic in us, right? Why would I place my trust? Why would I redirect my life? Why would I change my priorities all because of a book? I think it's a really reasonable question. I think it's a question that ought to be asked. Because if you're going to start making major life decisions based on a book, then who's to say you should choose this one? I mean, there are other religions that have books of their own. You could base your decisions on one of those. And so the question becomes, with all of the conflicting messages out there and all that's at stake, why would you consider entrusting your life to this book? And I want to tell you on Easter Sunday, I don't think you should. I don't think you ought to entrust your life to a book. But the reason I say that is because I think there's something much better to entrust with your life. Because the Christian faith is based on something that's so much bigger, so much better than just a book. Now, I want to explain that to you this morning by going back to the beginning of the Christian faith and pointing out something that you may or may not already realize, and that is that on the day Jesus died, on the day Jesus was killed, nobody expected to ever see him again. Nobody thought that they would see Jesus again. The followers of Jesus became former followers of Jesus on the day Jesus died. Once he died, everybody thought that he was dead forever. That meant that the people who had been traveling with him for those years of his ministry were suddenly trying to figure out, what are we going to do next? They saw what had happened to their leader. They were reasonably fearful that the religious leaders might come and give them some trouble too, just because of association. And so they were scared and they were aimless and they were trying to figure out what the future was going to hold. But all of them believed that the movement was over. I mean, the leader had died. The ride was over. Resurrection was not on the radar. Nobody expected to find an empty tomb. But just 2 days later, these people's lives were forever changed, and they would completely redirect their future, and they would reconsider everything that Jesus had ever said and ever done, and they would be swept up into this movement that would eventually become the Christian church. They would be a part of converting thousands and thousands of people to this new faith. And all of that happened, every bit of that happened, before a single word of the New Testament was written. The first people who gave their lives to following Jesus, the first people who became missionaries, the first people who became Christian ministers, the first people who became leaders in the church, the first people who became parents that raised Christian families, they did it without a Bible to guide them or to teach them or instruct them. They did not become sold out ambassadors for Jesus because of what they read in a Bible. They did it because something happened, because there was an event. They did it because on the evening of that first day of the week, when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." That's why they became re-followers of Jesus. It's because of a moment. It's because they were sitting there scared, and then all of a sudden Jesus showed up. It's because they were sitting there alone and confused, and Jesus arrived and he showed up and he offered peace when they didn't even deserve that. I mean, you think about it, every one of the followers of Jesus had abandoned Jesus at the moment when it really mattered the most. They ran for safety while his accusers were testifying that his life should be taken from him. Nobody was there to refute the charges. When asked about their connection to Jesus, some of these disciples denied ever knowing the man. In the moment when it was most important, they all cracked under pressure. But Jesus doesn't bring that up. He walks in. He sees this band of pitiful, anxious, former believers. And he offers peace in the midst of their panic. He says, "Peace be with you." And after he said that, he showed them his hands. And he showed them his side where he'd been wounded. And the disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. I mean, can you imagine the excitement in that room as they just went through stages of processing this? I mean, initially it's just shock and maybe even fear. What am I seeing right now? And then suddenly there's this celebration of Christ's return. And then it's kind of a overwhelming feeling as you're trying to process through the implications of what's just happened. I mean, if he could overcome death, then everything he ever said about himself and about us is true. And he had more to say. Verse 21, again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you," he says to his followers. And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, their sins are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven," he said. And just like that, with a breath, Jesus started a movement. With a breath, He initiated a faith. He changed history by just a breath. He reinstated every person in that room to full disciple status, and their lives were changed forever from that moment forward. But I want you to notice that there was not a book in sight. They didn't do this because they read about it in a book. They didn't do it because they studied history. Their lives were changed because they had an experience that could not be denied. They had an encounter with Jesus that reframed everything. But then John, who's writing this down, he says, oh yeah, but there was one person that was missing that wasn't there. Verse 24, now Thomas, one of the 12 disciples, was not with the group. He was not with the disciples when Jesus came. We don't know why. We don't know where he was, but we know that the other disciples went and tracked him down. And it says in the next verse, verse 25, the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. And they told him this incredible story. They told him the details of what they had seen together. But you know what an incredible story does, right? It brings out the inner skeptic in all of us. And Thomas, he's a lot like you and he's a lot like me. He doesn't just believe everything he hears. He's got a healthy skepticism about him. He's got a critical ear. And this is not just idle conversation. This is not something that you can easily sweep away. This is a history-changing claim that they've just offered to him. And Thomas is not just going to take their word for it. Frankly, this story sounds like fake news. It's so outrageous, so inconceivable that Thomas just, he can't go there. And so he said to them, he said, unless I see the nail marks in his hands, unless I see it, unless I put my finger where the nails were in his side and put my hand into his side over here, he says, I will not believe what you've told me. And with that statement, Thomas picks up a permanent nickname for himself, Doubting Thomas. But that's kind of ironic because he didn't ask for anything that the rest of the disciples had not already been given, did he? He just wanted to see. No one had anticipated this was going to happen. Nobody anticipated Jesus' return. Every single disciple had been a skeptic, and Thomas is no exception. But the others, they kept working on him. They kept trying to convince him. They kept telling the story. They kept trying to plead with him to believe. And that leads to one of my favorite verses in this entire book. And it's kind of a simple one, but verse 26 says, a week later, 7 days later, the disciples were in the house together again. And this time Thomas was with them. Thomas stuck around. He stuck around while he was with all of these people who had had a totally different spiritual experience than he had had. It must have been a long week wondering if he was ever going to get any validation, any proof of what his friends claimed they had seen. But at the end of the week, it says, though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. And then he looks right at Thomas. He looks right at Thomas and he says, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side there where that wound is. He says, stop doubting and believe. See, Jesus showed up for Thomas. He didn't let Thomas stay left out. And Thomas's doubt immediately melts away. And he says, my Lord and my God. It was like flipping a switch. I mean, Thomas made this bold and convicted commitment to Jesus. And it wasn't because somebody told him the story, although they did. And it wasn't because he read about it in a book. Thomas's life was changed because when he hadn't experienced Jesus himself, he stuck around. He stuck around and he leaned into the story of his friends. He stayed connected to the community of believers, and he carried all of his doubt and all of his skepticism with him until he had his own experience with the risen Jesus. And Jesus says to him, because you've seen me, you have believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. Now, if you read that in the wrong tone, it can sound as if Jesus is kind of coming down on Thomas for his doubt. And I don't think that's what it was intended there. I think Jesus is talking about you. I think Jesus is talking about me. I think Jesus is talking about those of us who haven't seen the scars firsthand. I think he's talking about those of us who are living with a hope that our faith is not foolish. I think Jesus is commending those of us whose belief requires even more faith than Thomas's belief did. You see, Thomas had more direct evidence. I think he got to hug Jesus. I think Jesus breathed the Holy Spirit into him too. Thomas got his proof, but these words that Jesus said, "Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed," those words were ringing in the ears of all of the disciples who were in that room. And so, a few days later, they're watching as Jesus ascends into the heavens, into the sky, and the realization starts to set in for them that, hey, it's up to us to let everybody else know about what we have experienced. And so that's what they did. They started to take the message far and wide, and they preached in synagogues and amphitheaters and town squares and courtrooms and prisons. They recounted the story of Jesus everywhere they went. But every time, the message was focused on the resurrection, because that really was the changing moment. That was what it was all about. Thousands of people, thousands upon thousands of people were converted. The church grew at an exponential, almost inexplicable rate long before a single word of the New Testament was ever written. Because this faith is not about the Bible. It's not about a book. This faith is about the event when the Lord was resurrected, and resurrection changed everything. Now the years passed, and those people who were out sharing their experience, it was hard on them. Sometimes they'd run into trouble. Sometimes they'd be falsely accused. Sometimes they would be taken into court. Sometimes they would be strung up. Eventually, some of them started to be killed for their faith. And so the numbers of the people who had experienced that moment started to dwindle. And they were all aging. And so at some point they realized Matthew, who was one of the eyewitnesses, one of the disciples who had been in that room, he said, "I'm going to have to write this stuff down so everybody can hear about what I experienced." And so he started writing, and he talked to some of his other eyewitness friends, and they wrote down all the stories that they could remember and everything they could remember that Jesus said. And Mark, he interviewed a bunch of eyewitnesses, and he started writing down the story of Jesus. And Luke, he was like an investigative reporter. I mean, he was turning over rocks and looking in every nook and cranny to find every detail he could find about Jesus. And then John was one of those who was there when that happened. And he wrote down the story because he wanted you to hear what he had experienced. And he wrote it down like this. He says, "Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of us, his disciples, which are not even recorded in this book." I didn't even write it all down, he says, "but these are written. I wrote these down so that you might believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing, you might have life in his name." John was writing with you in mind. He was writing with me in mind. He was hoping that all this evidence, the experiences that he had with Jesus would be persuasive, would be enough to help you believe, even though you didn't see Jesus the way John did. He was hoping that if he presented the evidence and told the story and shared what it meant to him, that it might mean something to you too. And that was incredible, but maybe not as incredible as this last one. There was a guy named James who literally was Jesus' kid brother, all right, grew up in the same house with Jesus. And for Jesus' entire life, James was unpersuaded by the claims that he was the Son of God. James did not believe that until he saw his brother alive again after he'd been dead. And then suddenly that changed everything. And he decided he had to dedicate his life to making sure that other people knew that message. And he wrote about his brother. He wrote about his brother who he had become convinced was the Son of God. And he did it so that you could hear about his experience. Now the trouble is, we got a lot of us that are a lot like Thomas. I mean, we're skeptical people. But the invitation, the challenge, the plea for you and for me is to consider what Thomas did. To stick around, to stay connected, to lean into the story of faith until that moment when you have your own experience with the resurrected Jesus. What I've noticed is it comes in a lot of different ways. Sometimes your experience with Jesus may come because you experience some healing. You experience something that feels like a miracle. You experience something that feels way, way too good to be true or too coincidental to really be a coincidence. It may be something awesome. Or it may be that it comes as relief in the midst of a storm. It may be that it comes as peace that can't be explained. It may be that it comes as a confidence that nobody else can have when things are rocky and things are difficult. It may be that it shows up as a voice that is so quiet you just barely feel like you're hearing anything. But you know, you wouldn't have responded that way on your own. And Jesus is showing up to work in your heart. And so that's going to be the invitation for you this Easter, to be someone who invites Jesus to make his presence known in your life. You don't have to take my word for it. In fact, we'll put it out there because I'm trusting Jesus to do this for you. It's not up to me. You be someone who says, Jesus, if this is real, I want to know. If this is real, I want to experience your presence. And the promise of Scripture, over and over and over again, from the beginning to the end, is that God says, when somebody seeks me with all their heart, I will allow myself to be found. I will allow myself to be discovered by you. And we invite you to that, to experience the risen Christ, to invite him to lead you into the next step of deeper faith in your own spiritual journey.